Hi, I'm Kylie Harwell Sturgill of WOSU Classical 101 in Columbus, Ohio, and I want to welcome you. This is our new podcast, Musicology 101. So you might be thinking, what is musicology? You know, aside from Prince's album. Musicology simply means the study of music. That can have a lot of different meanings. That can mean sort of the theory of music. It can mean the history of music, the appreciation and the reception of it. And it can also just mean the philosophy of music. So in this podcast, I'm going to attempt to sort of touch on all of those topics without really focusing too much on one or the other, aside from the history. That, to me, is the most interesting part of music because often it sort of automatically envelops the other aspects of music, including some theory and including some reception and the audiences that the music was geared towards originally. I'm going to be talking about two of my favorite topics, and those are music and beer. So why music and beer? Well, oftentimes it's easy for someone to get into a piece of music either by learning a little bit about the composer or composers, or by learning about sort of the historical climate in which the music was written. And one of my favorite eras of music is early chant. And in order to get into early chant, you know, it's sung in Latin. It's not in typical key signatures. It's not in typical time signatures. So it's a little bit removed from our vernacular. So in order to kind of get into the mindset of really appreciating this music, to me, it's really helpful to see what else was going on in Europe during the time that this music was being written, and what other sorts of things were being invented, and what other sorts of things were really being innovated at the same time, so that you can get a sense of what's new and what's exciting. Because this music was not ancient to them. This was new music. So thanks again for listening, and welcome to Musicology 101, a production of WOSU Classical 101. The year is 1040 AD. We know that monarchs were born, we know that monarchs are dying. Macbeth is literally the king of Scotland. There's a Danish king called Hard Knut, or Hard Knot, and he's actually taken the throne of England by force. Woodblock printing has already been invented in China, and the legend says that the famous Lady Godiva actually rode through Coventry with no clothing as a way to force her husband, the Earl of Mercia, to lower the taxes for his people. And this is also the year that Weihenstephan Abbey and Brewery is founded. So the abbey was technically founded back in 720 AD by St. Corbinian, and it was actually started as an Augustine abbey. The abbey later took on the Benedictine rule. So the Benedictine rule is surprisingly important, not just for the prayers and lifestyle of the monks, but really for their music and for their beer. So the monks didn't invent beer. Actually, beer is closer to about 6,000 years old. It's believed to have first been fermented in various forms in current-day Iran, and ancient Sumerians left behind specialized brewing pottery that we find today with traces of what's called calcium oxalate, which is also commonly known to brewers as beer stone. It still has to be kind of scraped off of kettles even today. But the monks at Weihenstephan definitely did make great contributions to the evolution of beer and music. So let's talk a little bit about how to make beer. And then we'll talk a little bit about how it relates to the process of making music. So to make beer today, brewers first soak malt, and then they mix the malt and warm water into what's called a mash tun to extract the starches and flavors. The temperature is then raised to convert enzymes from starch into sugar, and that sugar later feeds the yeast bacteria, and that leads to fermentation. And, of course, fermentation leads to alcohol. From this stage, you're left with this funny liquid called wort, which is drawn off into a brew kettle for a really hard boil. And that's going to sterilize the wort. It's going to create this gorgeous color, hopefully, if you're doing it right. And it's also going to take out unwanted protein strains. So at this point, wort is just kind of this, like, sweet brown liquid. It's not bad, but, you know, it's definitely not beer. It's definitely not got any carbonation either. Then flavor is added, and that is today we use hops. So hops are a perennial flower, and they're packed with this signature bitter flavor of beer. And the boiled hopped wort is then filtered and cooled to keep out other bacteria and gross things so that the yeast can be introduced to consume the sugars, produce the CO2, carbonate the beer, and then let it be aged. The beer is then kegged by filling it into a keg or a barrel from the bottom up. You know, think about that for a minute. Got to go from the bottom up because you don't want it to get all churned about. And then voila, you've got beer. So back at Weihenstephanen in the 11th century, how on earth were these monks producing beer when it's clear that this process really takes precision? And more importantly, it takes the keeping of time. You have to be accurate with your timekeeping. And this is a time at which they obviously didn't have functioning clocks as we think of them today. Beer making is a really scientific task, and it requires careful observation. You've got to be able to take notes, which means you've got to be able to read and write, which most people in the 11th century could not do. And you also have to be able to keep really precise recipe recordings and temperature modification. So these processes really would have required sort of the height of innovation in science at this point in the 11th century. They may seem sort of benign today, but, you know, we've all got stoves and little ding clocks and smartphone watches and all kinds of stuff. But these guys, you know, they had fire and they had the sun and they had a few innovations around that. But otherwise, they were doing it the hard way. But luckily, Weihenstephan was a Benedictine abbey. And a Benedictine abbey would have specifically been home to learned men who could read, write, and spend hours devoting themselves to the recording of time and observations about their tasks. Monasteries were the centers of innovation. So this is the perfect place for beer and for music to have really taken off. So let's look at the fact that Weihenstephan was specifically a Benedictine abbey. That's really important. The Benedictine tradition began in 529. Weihenstephan was a Benedictine abbey. The Order of Benedict began in a list of guidelines for living. So after living some time in what's called pious isolation, but could also be referred to as hermitage, Benedict founded his rule with a definitive purpose for community instead of solitude. And so he established this rule for both men and women. Now, the Benedictine order focused specifically on programs for education, art, architecture, and manuscript writing. These elements sort of conglomerated together to produce a monastery of well-educated men who were not restricted from speaking with outsiders, as some monastic orders were. So here in this concept of communal living, we really see the essentials provided to these people for the knowledge of brewing and their adherence of always offering food and drink to their guests who were welcome at their abbey would have also made a necessity for the consistent production of larger quantities of food and larger quantities of beer than had really ever been produced. One other essential factor of Benedictine living in and of itself that also sort of relates to both music and beer really intrinsically is timekeeping. So timekeeping was really crucial for monks for their maintaining and changing of the times of day at which they sang, and it's also crucial for making beer. When you're brewing, you have to maintain and change temperature correctly on time. So how can you do it in the 11th century? The practice of daily prayers given at specific times of day was not a new phenomenon in the 11th century. In fact, the Roman Catholic Church had actually already taken the practice from the Jewish tradition, as we can see in the Book of Psalms, 119, verse 164. quote unquote, seven times a day I praise you for your righteous laws. This seems, you know, not like a big deal, but if you think of it as a way of keeping time, that's really remarkable. So if they're regimenting their lives based on these seven times a day, then they're going to have a much better sense of time. So this concept was taken by Simeon of Thessaloniki, who then wrote, "The times of prayer and the services are seven in number, like the number of the gifts of the Spirit." And then later, in 525, our great friend Benedict, who founded the Benedictine Order, set out one of the earliest full schemas for the complete recitation of the Psalter. So by the 11th century, Reformed Benedictine priories underwent this really emphatic emphasis on liturgy. And they were really pressing the importance of the canonical hours, and it was called the Cluniac Reforms. So this Cluniac Reform featured strict adherence to communal timetable known as the horarium. This horarium was dictated for every single monk's routine, every single facet of their life, their work, their prayers, their meals were very, very regimented. And in this way, we see that the Benedictine monks would have actually had a very good sense of time, as you need to do in brewing. So these monks at Weihenstephan would have been praying and singing as their beers were brewing. By 1040, we know that the Benedictine monks would have transitioned from something called plain chant to Gregorian chant. Plain chant, also known as cantus planus, is a form of unison monophonic music without any sense of meter or time signature. Okay, what does that mean? So unison monophonic music means you've got a series of men singing the same notes at the same time, on the same key, everything's the same. It's plain chant. And there's no sense of meter or time signature, meaning you don't have a downbeat, you don't have, you know, any emphasis on beat aside from the sort of typical quality of speech. So the Latin chant dictated how things felt in terms of time and in terms of rhythm. It was really, really intrinsic. It was very speech-like. Gregorian chant was named for the legendary Pope Gregory I, and that is a more developed form of monophonic singing that uses various intervallic patterns or skips and leaps of notes to establish what are called modes and what we call now cadences. This is sort of the predecessor of the modern key signature or a tonic note. So Gregorian chant was actively spread from modern-day Germany and England, and it was actually imported back to Rome and Paris. And one of the epicenters of plain chant composition during this time was at Regensburg, which, as it happens, is located just over 100 kilometers, or roughly 60 miles, from Weihenstephan. These two centers would have had communication. These two centers of monastic learning would have communicated about music, who knows, maybe even about beer. So we see that these guys were sharing information and they were not closed off from each other as much as the rest of the medieval world. During the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church also taxed beer that was made at home. They had a way of selling this desired spice mix, which is called gruet. So people would brew gruet, and it was a type of ale, and it had a secret mixture of herbs and roots, such as yarrow and myrtle root, which the Catholic Church would sell to brewers, and mostly lady brewers, for a really steep price. So the church was involved in your home life, it was involved in your brewing life, you knew the music from church, and you even drank basically church beer. So the earliest beers made at Weihenstephan would have been very familiar to the people around that area, and so would have the music. The music would have been integrated into their church life. The earliest beers made at Weihenstephan would have likely been made with an ancestor of the most common hops of the region today, which is the Bavarian Hallertau hops. Please forgive my German. It's not fantastic. But on the note of hops, we know that there was actually some brewing in the area of Weihenstephan as early as 768, since there's an existing document that survives today which describes a nearby hops garden at a homestead. This is really interesting because this homestead probably would have used hops and other agricultural sources to pay their tithes to the church rather than, you know, monetary tithes. They very well could have given these exact Hallertau hops to Weihenstephan as their tithing. Today, the Weihenstephan Hefeweiss beer is still being produced and is actually the number one ranked beer on Beer Advocate Germany. So where do music and beer have to take us today? It was with this kind of question in mind that I called up my friend and the maestro of the Las Vegas Philharmonic, Donato Cabrera. And Donato and I have shared beers in the past, so I knew he would really have some insight into how a musician can approach music today and how a beer person, basically, can approach beer today, and where can we find the crossovers between the two today? And we really discovered that there's a lot to be done between music and beer. Donato, what do you think about beer, and how do you think it relates to music, and what's your favorite drink right now?
Well, that's a great question, and as I was thinking about the history of beer, as you just mentioned with Weihenstephan, Abbey, you know, in 1048, it sort of follows the history of music in a very interesting and close way. You know, I think there's actually a very close connection with beer and with music, certainly in terms of us artists appreciating a concert when it's over.
Yeah.
In a group, and beer, and of course, wine and other things are enjoyed. Certainly for me, my first experience really in Europe as a young aspiring conductor was in Bavaria, and what better place to experience beer than one of the great beer producing regions in the world. Certainly Weihenstephan was one of the many beers I encountered while there conducting. I was lucky enough to be asked to conduct three operas in a very, very small opera house in the Bavarian countryside, sort of in the foothills of the Alps south of Munich. Three operas were Barber Seville and Tosca and Rigoletto.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, it's funny. Think of these grand operas, especially Tosca,
mm-hmm.
with a very small orchestra of around 10 musicians.
Oh, my gosh.
Performing in a former bank building that had 120 seats. There are small little tables that cocktail tables, really, that four chairs would be stationed around, and folks, these wonderful people who loved opera, most of whom I'm guessing were BMW executives and retirees, they would be sitting there eating their wonderful cheeses and drinking sect, normally not beer.
Oh, right.
Enjoying these miniature performances of these great operas. Anyway, that was really my first exposure to European culture, and you know, we think of opera here in the United States as being one of the grand experiments of culture, but there, you know, it's really still part of everyday life.
Right.
Opera happens every day, and it happens on various sizes and scales. And in fact, what's interesting now in the United States, I see opera sort of becoming that. You know, these little pocket opera companies popping up in normally bigger cities, but these not just performing in an opera house, but performing in a train station and performing it in people's living rooms, and I think this is this sort of development is very good for the art form and speaks to its universality.
It's funny that you say it like that, because mm-hmm. to me that is a parallel again of beer. What are we doing in the U.S.? We've gone from these giant Anheuser and Heiser giant conglomerations. And mm-hmm. what are we doing now? We're having craft beers, home brews, and microbreweries. Do you think that kind of concept of coming back to grassroots is something that is just, that's just what our culture is experiencing right now, what we're thirsty for, to excuse the pun?
yes, and to have a short answer,
okay.
I do sense this sort of desire to be localized, to have a one-on-one experience with everything,
yeah.
including beer and music, and in fact, I was just in Las Vegas this earlier part of this week. I'm music director of Las Vegas Philharmonic, and I had a shoot in a record store. And
I saw that.
Yeah, and now this isn't a record store that's been around for 50 years and that's somehow survived the onslaught of technology. But no, it's a record store that opened up about 6 months ago.
Oh my
and
gosh.
They just, that's all they do. They sell vinyl. And in the back of this building, they have a recording studio. It's in a way one could look at this as a niche sort of mm-hmm. way of bringing back something that might to some people seem archaic. But I think actually the whole idea of the analog experience, of course, vinyl represents, is something that people are needing, are wanting to experience on a day-to-day basis, and not feel so disconnected from everything they own or listen to or eat or drink.
Yeah.
And this is obviously the case with beer in the last 25, 30 years in the United States.
Absolutely.
Of course, being here in San Francisco, where I live, you know, with Sierra Nevada and other microbreweries that sort of were in many ways a vanguard of the craft beer movement, it's a very wonderful thing to see, and it's a well-established sort of process here, as of course the slow food movement and the farm to table experience that you can now find in many, many restaurants, not of course just here in San Francisco, but around the country. And I think music is particularly opera and classical music is sort of going through that same process, same experience of becoming localized, of not just being in the Grand Opera House or the Symphonic mm-hmm. Hall, but in various communities, whether it be through chamber music or smaller regional orchestras, it's a wonderful thing to see and to be a part of.
So with all of these things in mind, with the history of beer and a tiny snippet of the history of music under your belt, I want to encourage you to do what Donato is doing and what I enjoy doing, which is to look for musicians outside of the usual concert venue, to even maybe get to know some of them over a beer. In fact, this week, you have that opportunity with Early Music Columbus, Wolf's Ridge Brewing, and Laughlin's Bakery. They're doing a fantastic show, and you can read more about it on the blog. I encourage you to go, and let's grab a beer together. This is Musicology 101 with Kylie Harwell Sturgill, as a production of WOSU Public Media Classical 101. Thanks so much. If you enjoyed today's program and you want to hear more podcasts like this, I want to encourage you to also go to wosu.org, click on the red donate button, and become a member. These programs are supported by listeners like you.